Well, good morning. If you'd like to turn with me to the book of Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21, where we'll be studying from this morning. As we begin, I want to express my appreciation for the opportunity to be with you. So very much. Appreciate the invitation of your elders to be part of your fellowship this week. I don't expect there are many present this morning that were a part of the Cy-Fair congregation in 1979. But in 1979, I began doing local work in Oakwood, Texas. And this congregation helped support me for those 2 years while I was in that work. And so I have a fondness for this church that goes back that many years, but this is my first time to be a part of your fellowship like this in a gospel meeting. So I appreciate very much that opportunity. And I appreciate the opportunity to be with Mark. Drew's grandparents attended with us when we were in our old building at College Park. Ruth and Larry Bonner were some of the finest people that we've ever had there. Eventually, they had to move to Tulsa because of age and have since passed away. But it was such a blessing to have Ruth and Larry. So I knew Drew when he was a young fellow. I held a meeting at Arlington and ate in their home. So I have a connection back with him as well. And so I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here and look forward to meeting many of you. I realize that I am in the Houston area. However, I am not a Houston sports fan. So all I have are Dallas illustrations. So I plead for mercy. The Dallas Cowboys are a frustrating team because we still think they are America's team. I think probably they're America's laughing stock. It's been several years since we have been in any kind of serious playoff competition. But back in the 90s, when we had the triplets, Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, and Michael Irvin, and Jimmy Johnson had taken the place of the legendary great man Tom Landry, the Cowboys won 3 out of 4 Super Bowls and probably should have won 5 out of 5, except for some mistakes by the owner and Jimmy Johnson and Jerry Jones not getting along too well. The interesting thing about all 3 of those Super Bowls is that at no time in any one of those games was it ever in doubt that the Cowboys were going to win. They were that dominant. I do remember, however, the Houston Oilers, when they were really the Oilers. And you had Dan Pastorini and you had Bum Phillips as the combination head coach and quarterback. And I remember several years there under Bum Phillips that the Houston Oilers would go to the playoffs. And I remember one game in which it seemed like the Oilers were destined to win. I mean, they had a big lead going into the game. I think it was against the Buffalo Bills. It didn't seem like the Bills could ever come back. But lo and behold, as the Oilers often found a way to do, they found a way to lose. And the Bills came back and beat them. If you were a fan of the Dallas Cowboys and you're sitting there watching their game, you were assured they were going to win. If you were an Oilers fan, there was always a question mark in the back of your mind, when were they going to blow it? They're ultimately going to lose the game. And if you left early because the Oilers were so far ahead, you missed the comeback of the Buffalo Bills. Of course, it probably spared you greater disappointment of seeing the disaster. The book of Revelation helps us know who is going to win. It helps us see the end from the beginning. And we don't have to worry about coming down to the end and wondering, is the team of God going to lose in the final analysis? That God's people don't have to sit as mere spectators waiting for God and His team to blow it. God's team ultimately is victorious. Now that's important, not so I would have a good illustration to start the lesson, but that's important because the people in Revelation are facing some very challenging times. Many have their life being threatened. Many have their livelihood being threatened. And John is trying to tell them, but not just tell them, but tell us by extension, as we read their letter, the letter to the seven churches of Asia, that we can know what they knew. That God ultimately is victorious. And in Revelation chapter 21 and chapter 22, John presents for us what I've entitled John's Pictures of Victory. And I'd like for us to think about some of these this morning. And I hope to accomplish the objective to help us see what they saw and help us realize that regardless of what takes place in our lives, that with God, there will be victory. In chapter 21, beginning in verse 1, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, and there shall be no more pain, for the former things are passed away." Let's pause there. The first thing I want you to see is that John presents a picture of perfect fellowship. Perfect fellowship. I want you to see that in what he says in verse 3. "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and they will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God." John uses the imagery of the tabernacle. You'll recall from your Old Testament history that the tabernacle was that movable tent that the Israelites had as they were involved in their wilderness wanderings those many years. The temple is yet to be built out in the future, but here is the tabernacle of God. And you'll remember the tabernacle of God was where the presence of God was considered to be. That when they came to the tabernacle of God, they were coming into the presence of God. When they were coming into the tabernacle, they were coming into the presence of being in fellowship with God. And so John pulls that up as an illustration for them when he talks about here, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men." And what John wants to help us see with regard to this is that when we are with God, we are in His presence. It's interesting that all the cities that men have built, for example, you go back to the Tower of Babel, and that city that was there, every city that man has placed his name on has fallen. But that which God has built continues to stand. And here he tells us that we can come into the presence of God and be with Him. And in His presence with Him, we can come comforted and assured with every thought, every attitude, every disposition of our heart being revealed to God and God knowing us. And then there's something else that John stamps here when he says, "And they shall be His people and God Himself will be with them and be their God." This next statement, I hope I don't offend anybody. I don't mean to be cute with it. I'm not trying to denigrate at all the sentiment. When we lose a loved one, it's often said, well, I can't wait to be in heaven with them. Well, I agree with that. I've lost some loved ones that I think they have the hope of heaven, and I appreciate that sentiment very much. But what is going to be valuable about heaven is not going to be with our loved ones. How many times have we said with some intractable question that we can't answer, I can't wait to ask Paul. I can't wait to ask Abraham. I don't think that when we're in the presence of God, we're going to be concerned with that question we have now about asking Paul. I think we're in the presence of God, all those questions will be insignificant. But what makes heaven heaven is not going to be the trappings that are described here in glorious detail. But what is going to make heaven heaven is because God is there. We have fellowship with God. And those who have fellowship with God will be with Him. My physical address is 1406 Shadow Hills Drive in Wiley, Texas. That's where the house is located. But that's not where my home is. My home is at that address because that's where my wife is at. And wherever my wife is, that's where home is. Because she's there, that makes that domicile home. And because God is there, that's what makes heaven heaven. Now, if in the end, everything that John describes in physical detail, if the streets are of gold, the gates are of pearl, and all those things are there, then that's just going to be peachy king, hunky-dory, however God wants to make it, God can make it. But what's going to be significant is not going to be the way it is described. What's going to be significant is we will be in perfect fellowship with God. I realize that we have fellowship with God today, but not like we're going to have fellowship with God then. It will be in its reality, not in its hope. We're assembled like this as God's people today, coming into His presence with the disposition of having fellowship with Him. But that fellowship will be something we have never seen or ever imagined before. Today, when we read this from John chapter 21 and verse 3, we can only talk about it. We can only imagine the image of the tabernacle. We can only imagine what it will be to be with God. But then, it will be a reality. And that fellowship will be a fellowship that will be unimagined. And so John will tell us the first picture he wants us to see is fellowship with God. The second thing I want you to see, beginning in verse 4, reading down through verse 8. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, for there shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the waters of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. The second thing I want you to see in this picture that John paints for us really begins in verse 4, and that is, there will be perfect happiness. Notice what John describes in verse 4. He talks about tears. He talks about death. He talks about sorrow. We live with those things every day. We live with the concern every day. Are we going to have a job tomorrow? In this kind of frenetic market that we have with jobs, Can we really work for the same company for 42 years? That seems to be unheard anymore. That you can have that kind of longevity because there are buyouts and there are layoffs. Are we going to have a paycheck tomorrow? Will we be able to take care of the bills tomorrow? Furthermore, he talks about there'll be no more death. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine being where there is no more death. We are surrounded by death all the time. Death invades. It's unwanted guest that comes into every person's life sooner or later. It doesn't matter how old or how young or what the circumstances is, there's never a time that it's convenient for us to have said goodbye. And yet we come in the memorial of those that we've lost. and tears come flowing down. Hearts are broken. Lives are left empty. There are holes in the hearts of survivors that can never be filled. And yet John says, no more death. No more tears. No more broken hearts. No more disappointment. No more shattered dreams. No more crushing defeats of life. No more tears. And what John wants us to see is he wants us to see in this perfect picture of happiness that everyone there will belong. Everyone there will have a place. And he says, and they shall be my sons, and they shall be my daughters. Everyone there will belong to God. And everyone there whose name will be changed, whose very nature will be changed because of their fellowship with God, because they have been in contact with the Son who has transformed them into His very image. That which they began will not be that who they are when they are presented before God. We'll undergo that transformation process that we'll talk about Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, throughout this life, but never complete it. But God will complete that picture for us. Every heart will seek His passion. Every foot will follow His path. Every hand will seek to serve. Every eye will behold His glory and His majesty. And John says, there will be perfect happiness. Can you imagine? There's a movie out now after the song of many years ago, I Can Only Imagine. Can you only imagine living with God in perfect fellowship and perfect happiness? And then I want you to see a third thing that John will help us see here. He says in verse 9, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked to me saying, come and I will show you the bride and the lamb's and the lamb's wife. Drop down to verse 14. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates and its walls. And the city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. Then he measured its walls, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is of an angel. And the construction of its wall was of jasper. The city was pure gold like glass, and the foundations of the wall were adorned with these kinds of precious stones. And he lists the precious stones. What I want you to see that John paints here, John paints a picture of perfect security. Perfect security. We're concerned about security. We have security alarms on our homes. Just recently, I had this Ring doorbell installed on my home and a camera installed looking out over my garage. And so now, anytime there's any movement, even if the wind blows, that Ring alarm goes off on my phone. And inevitably, what happens is I've got a cat coming along or the basketball goal net waved in front of the camera. I've yet to have an invader. However, my neighbors have, we're on a neighborhood thing, and they'll show when somebody comes up to ring the doorbell. And last night, I noticed this morning on the neighborhood thing, there were some kids doing some doorbell ringing and running off. When I was a kid ringing doorbells and running, nobody had Ring cameras on the doorbell. But we're concerned about security. Our children go out. We're concerned about their safety. We put a GPS on their phone. We put a Find a Friend on their phone. We can track their phone and we can see where they're at so we know that they're safe. We give them instructions. Call us when you get there. When I was in college, traveling from Denton, Texas to Commerce, Texas, there was no phone along the way. You had to wait until you got to Commerce in order to call Mom and Dad to tell you I was there. Now, there are a few cities I could stop if I had the money to use a payphone, but there was no cell phone to call Mom and Dad and say, when I get to Frisco, I'm this far. When I get to McKinney, I'm this far. When I get to Greenville, I'm this far. When I get to Commerce, I'm here. It was understood that if Mom and Dad didn't hear anything until I got to Commerce, an hour and a half later, things were okay. When my daughter was dating her to be husband, we lived in the Dallas area. He lived in Fort Scott, Kansas, which was about 6 hours away. Well, one weekend, she just was bound and determined she had to see Chris. Oh, her heart was breaking because it had been several weeks since she'd seen Chris. They'd been talking on the phone. Oh, she had to see him. And so she came to me and said, "Dad, can I drive to Fort Scott and see Chris?" And I thought, 6 hours in a Toyota Camry on the way to Fort Scott, Kansas. I'm not sure about that. However, we had a cell phone. And so every hour I let her go, I would call her on the cell phone to make sure that she was safe. Her mother thought I had lost my mind because that was not safe. We are concerned with our security. We want to feel safe. That's important for us. Security is one of the number one issues that we face personally and as a family. But notice what John says here. In verse 9, he says, "One of the seven angels who had seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife,' and then drop down to verse 14. And he said, 'The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the name of the 12 apostles of the Lamb.'" And then he begins to describe in verse 18, 19, and following the foundation that is there. This is a foundation that is hewn out of these precious stones. And hewn out of these precious stones, you can see how sure this foundation really is. John is using imagery with these stones that will paint for us a picture that we can see, because these stones still carry the same kind of precious value for us even today. And what John is helping us see here is that when we are with God, we will be able to walk on a rainbow. In fact, the colors of the rainbow are mentioned here. You have what he says is sapphire. You have sardonyx. You have emerald. You have what he says as amethyst. So you have the blue. You have the yellow. You have the purple. You have the green. All the things that you see in a rainbow are there. And what he's trying to get us to see here is here is our assurance. Have you ever looked at a rainbow and seen how pretty it is and think, "I would love to walk on top of a rainbow"? Well, with God, you can walk on top of a rainbow. But notice the sure foundation that is laid. And then I want you to see, turning to chapter 22. Turn to chapter 22. I want you to see the perfect provisions. The perfect provisions that are made. Look at what he will say beginning in verse 1. "And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of his street, on either side of the river, was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. And his servants shall serve him. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads." But notice, verse 2 is where I want you to see. Notice, he talks about this tree. He talks about this river flowing through the city, and on the banks of the river are these trees. But he talks about the tree yielding its fruit every month. In other words, here you have the provisions that are there. Here you have the life-sustaining provisions that are always available. We sing the song "Amazing Grace." When we've been there 10,000 years, it'll be bright, shining as the sun. Well, here are God's bountiful provisions that 10,000 years will never, never go without. And here is the tree. He takes this imagery back to the garden. He takes this imagery back to the Garden of Eden, where you had the lush Garden of Eden, where all the provisions were there for Adam and Eve. They were to work in to tend the garden. Of that one tree they could not eat, but of every tree in the garden they could eat but that one. The garden yielded life-sustaining provisions for Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve never wanted for anything with regard to life. And so John at the end will take us back to the beginning. John will take us back to that beginning scene of the garden. That which was lost, John will say, has now been restored. We can only imagine once again what it would be like to be in that garden with Adam and Eve. But now then, with God, it shall be a reality and we shall see what it will be like to be in that heavenly garden with Him, with trees that are lining the river as it flows through the city and yielding abundant fruit for us every day of our lives. No one is going to go hungry. No one is going to go without. Everyone will be bountifully provided for us. And so John said, the leaves of his tree leaf for the healing of all the nations. All that are there will be healed. Forgiveness, I think, is what he's talking about here primarily. But there's going to be no want. There's going to be no sickness. There's going to be no death. No more sorrow that is there because the provisions of God have been made available for us. How many times have we witnessed people begin their journey with the Lord? But only because of the lack of one of the four things that we've mentioned so far. They, for some reason or the other, have walked away. In other words, they're watching the game. And as they're watching the game be played, they begin to lose. And they begin to be convinced that now they're on the losing team. And they leave the game early. And leaving the game early miss the comeback and the outcome. Nobody who experiences the provisions of God is going to be sorry that they endured in the game of faith. Everyone will be victorious. Everyone will rejoice. And the point that John wants us to see here, as he will say in chapter 6, as you look at verse 11 of chapter 6, he kind of paints the picture of what's going on here with these folks. And we'll refer to this again in the assembly period hour. But notice what he says in verse 9, or verse 10. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" And a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number and their fellow servants and their brethren would be killed as they were completed. Notice the saints are crying out, "How long, O Lord, how long?" And John is trying to get them to see that don't despair. Don't quit. Don't give up. You hang in there. You keep your faith. You keep in this game of faith. You keep in this game of life and serving the Lord. Because in the end, you're going to be on the winning team. I think that's important for us. An application kind of thing for just a few moments. Because we live in a world that, as we all know, is so temporal. And it's also so dominated by the flesh. It's dominated by what is at the point of our nose. The urgency is at the point of our nose is, and we don't have that long-term sort of look with our lives. Whatever immediately happens seems to be the most urgent. We see that in the sports world, we see it in politics, we see it in life. What we have happening today in the world is not something that is new to our time. If you look back through the period of history that human existence has taken place, everything that is happening today has happened at some other time in human history. It may wear a different dress. It may present itself a different way. But the battle is still the same. On one side, you have Satan. On the other side, you have God. On one side, you have evil. On the other side, you have good. On one side, you have wickedness. On the other side, you have righteousness. That's the battle that's been going on since Genesis chapter 3. Satan used what to appeal? Satan didn't appeal to the heart of Adam and Eve. Satan appealed to the eye, to the flesh, the desire, the sensation of Adam and Eve. Those are the very things that Satan used with the Lord in the garden. He used that which appealed to the flesh. Hunger, sensation, pride, the possession of the nations. What Satan was saying is to the Lord is, "I can give you all of these." He said to Eve, "I can give you all of this." Eve believed it. Eve partook. Jesus resisted. Jesus didn't do anything in Matthew chapter 4 that's impossible for us to do. He did have a perfect will. He did have a perfect knowledge. His character was perfect. That's what we strive to become. But He sets the model for us that when we appeal to what is written, we can resist the evil one. I say that from a personal basis. I say that to each one of us. Because our concern, our challenge in life is resisting the evil one. Perhaps it will not be through some immorality. Perhaps it will not be through drunkenness. Perhaps it will not be by violently taking someone's life. Perhaps it will not be through some kind of graft or some kind of corruption. But it may simply be because we in our hearts have given our hearts to Him and made the physical, made this world more important than the spiritual and the eternal. That's so hard to keep in focus when we live in real time. In real time, we need to see this picture that John paints for us. That in real time, we'll have fellowship, we'll have happiness, we'll have security, and we'll have the provisions that God offers for us, and none are going to be without. Everyone will belong. Everything that we suffer today shall be assuaged. It shall be comforted. Everything that we're worried about being taken from us shall be secure. And everything that we're concerned with the want shall be provided. In other words, you're not going to have to worry about living in Houston and facing the 500-year flood again. Now, in Dallas, we didn't experience that. We felt sorry for you folks. We hurt for folks down here and down south below because of what you experienced. But you're not going to face that kind of loss. We're not going to face the disappointment of a mate that has left. We're not going to face the disappointment of a child that has walked away. We're going to be in perfect fellowship with God. Satan works on us every day. He is the adversary. He gets off cheap. He gets off easy. Because we always say, why did God? And you fill in the blank. There's somebody else. Isn't that the story of Job? Isn't the story of Job to show us there's an adversary and there's a victor? Isn't it interesting that in the story of Job, that Job simply asks, does Job fear God for naught? He doesn't point an accusing finger at Job to say, I'm going to tell you, you've bought him off. He says, did Job fear God for naught? And God said, you can take what he has, but you can't touch him. Then he says, you can touch him, but you can't take his life. And none of those things, did Job ever quit on God. And none of those things did Job ever lose his faith in God. Now, Job stumbled a little bit along the way. He faltered along the way. And I dare say, I think we probably would have done the same thing had we endured what Job endured. There were some tragic things that he endured. And then he had some friends that were trying to also convince him of something that he had not done. And what he's trying to get them to see is, no, I haven't done that. Now, what Job did learn along the way was he spoke a little presumptuously. When he in essence said, if I could have 5 minutes with God, I could straighten God out. He learned in the end, as he says in chapter 42, I spoke when I should remain silent. I should have waited, because God in chapter 38 speaks and says, were you there when I created the world? Have you ever taken a hippopotamus and spun him by the tail? In other words, if you weren't there, then stay quiet and stay still. And God bless Job. The challenge to me of the book of Ecclesiastes, I saw on the screen y'all studying on Wednesday night, so I don't mean to be contradicting somebody or stealing somebody's thunder here. But the challenge of the book of Ecclesiastes is, how do you live life under the sun? And Solomon's assessment of that is, you don't. Solomon's assessment of life under the sun when he begins the book is this. It's vanity and vexation of spirit. His assessment at the end of the book is, it's vanity and vexation of spirit. The idea of vanity is futility. The idea of vanity is emptiness. The idea of vexation is ultimate frustration. How many times do we see people pursuing? Here they have their labor. Here they have their work. Here's their pursuit. They're pursuing life under the sun. But he says there's never enough to make someone happy. Isn't that what happens with people all the time, whether it be an individual corruption or a corporation that's corrupt? I read the history of some things not long ago in Enron. And the thing that was amazing about that was, at any particular time, that thing could have been saved and turned around. Except the people that were running it never had enough. And there was always a grasping after the wind. Have you ever tried to catch the wind? Have you reached out to try to catch the wind? And then you open your hand and there's nothing? My grandchildren, even my kids when they were young, when they come to the house, we buy this soap in a bottle. Wouldn't you like to have come up with that idea? Dishwater soap in a bottle. Put a stick in it with a hole, pull it out, blow on it, and bubbles come. That is an ingenious invention. You blow on that and the bubbles come out. And what do the kids do? They chase after it. And they chase after it. They reach for their hand to grab it. And when they open, there's nothing there. That's what the pursuit of this world is about. The pursuit of this world is vanity and grasping after the wind. In fact, he calls it an evil disease. It is ultimately filled with frustration. And then here's a man that Solomon will talk about that labors for all of this all the days of his life, and his table is set and he cannot even sit down and enjoy it. In fact, he will talk about the man who has no family. And he's spending all of his day, he's a workaholic, spending all of his days working. And as he spends all of his days working, he never stops to ask, "For whom do I toil?" Do you remember the movie several years ago called The Family Man with, I think it was Nicolas Cage? He was this executive that was high on Wall Street and pursuing his wealth, and he was totally consumed with what he was going to consume. But then he has this kind of epiphany of a dream, kind of like the Scrooge thing that takes place with three different dreams, in which now he imagines himself as a family man, and now has a wife and two children, and now he's working at his father-in-law's tire shop. And his father-in-law has a heart attack. He saves his father-in-law. And now then the time comes for the dream to be over, and he has to go back to be the Wall Street tycoon. And what he's realized is, being that person all alone is not where fulfillment is at. You have this, but you have no one to share it with. Solomon tries to get us to see ultimately in the book of Ecclesiastes that life under the sun is not fulfilling. On the other hand, take Paul in the book of Philippians. Paul in the book of Philippians will never use the language that Solomon uses in Ecclesiastes. Paul will never say, "All is vanity and vexation of spirit." He will say, "Rejoice," and again I say rejoice, and always rejoice, even in the times in which things under the sun are difficult. In fact, Paul will take all those experiences of life under the sun and say, "To me, they were nothing. They were not gain." Secular history has recorded that Saul of Tarsus probably came from a very wealthy family. The Holy Spirit revealed to us that he came from the tribe of Benjamin. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was being fast-tracked to be the head of the Sanhedrin. Nobody excelled him. And regarding all that, he said, "I gave it up that I may know Christ and the power of His resurrection and the fellowship of His sufferings." Now, how in the world does all that tie back into the book of Revelation? I didn't just chase those tangents for the purpose of chasing tangents. What I just talked about from Job and Ecclesiastes was there was always something wanting. And John says in the book of Revelation, there'll be perfect fellowship. There's always something pursued. And John says in the book of Revelation, there will be perfect happiness. There's always someone that's going to come and take it away. And John will say there'll be perfect security. And there's always the want for more. And you can't enjoy what you have. And John says there will be perfect provisions. The streets are cobbled with gold. Its pathways always point in the right direction. And those who walk its pathways, those golden cobbled streets, will never stumble or fall away. Kindness is the norm. The straight way is the broad way. Truth is on every tongue. Service is the habit. Love is the motivation. Filled with good deeds. Filled with good things. Filled with ultimate fulfillment. Nobody nobody who involves himself in the game of faith and stays with the Lord till the end of the game is ever going to worry about how it ends. God wins. God not will be victorious, but God is victorious. The question mark for me and you is, number one, will we be on His team? And number two, will we continue with Him in the game of life and game of faith? Well, I don't know what the time is of this, but I learned a long time ago, when you're done, quit. And so I'm done, and I'm going to quit. Whatever time you got left, I'm going to give you the change back, because somewhere during the week I'll probably spend it. So thank you for your attention. Thank you so much.